My name is Jane Stevens. I am founder and publisher of ACES Connection Network. ACES Connection Network is ACES Too High, which is a news site for the general public, and ACES Connection, which is a social network for people who are implementing or thinking about implementing trauma-informed and resilience-building practices based on ACES science. And I'm here to talk about ACES science and how people and organizations and systems and communities are implementing the trauma-informed and resilience-building practices based on this new and very interesting research. What I'm going to be talking about today is sort of the bad news, good news approach that I think this requires to really give people a good overview of what this ACE science is. So as Michael mentioned, ACE's Connection Network is two parts. It's ACES Too High, which is a new site for the general public. It covers about information about the ACE science and how people are implementing it. And then the second part is ACES Connection Network. It's a social network for people who are implementing or thinking about implementing trauma-informed and resilience-building practices. Whoops, we're not. I see everything and you're not seeing anything. All right, hold on a second. Yay, perfect. Thank you. All right, now we'll work on it. Okay, this is what you missed. This slide and this slide. Okay, so that's where we are. So on ACES Connection Network, it's a social network, as I mentioned, and it's a little bit different from a Facebook type of social network, because it's there more for people who are actually doing the implementing or thinking about implementing this trauma-informed and resilience-building practices based on ACES science, as I mentioned. So what we do on here is we tell stories, we encourage other people to tell stories. What we essentially do is do our best to shorten the time it takes good information to get from people who are using it to the people who need it. We have more than 8,800 people on this network now. I would say about 10% are from outside the U.S. And they come from cross-sector, healthcare, education, criminal justice, law enforcement, civic community, business and faith-based communities. We send them information every day about the latest developments that we find in ACES research and reports and news, as well as a weekly roundup of information. Here's my team. You can tell the grandma up there, she's the one that puts the dark glasses on her grandchild. So we're entering an age, as Michael alluded to, that is really profound, I think. I think it's our modern renaissance. And a lot of people think that we're already doing this because of the digital age that we're in, but this is even more profound. Or it can be if we use this information. It's a brand new understanding of ourselves. So some people call this new understanding the theory of everything in human development. Other people call it the unified science of human development. Today I'll explain what comprises this unified science. I call it ACES science. If anybody has a shorter version that they come up with, please let me know, because I think the unified science of human development is a really big mouthful. I like something like Facebook or Twitter, you know, something like that. So I'll talk about the five parts of this unified science, how it's being implemented, and the remarkable systems-changing lessons learned so far from people who've been implementing ACES science, and how all this together offers us the ability to create self-healing communities. This all starts with the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. It was done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente, which is a health maintenance organization in the US, with 17,000 people in San Diego, California. In 1995 and 1996, and it was published in 1998, the first of about 70 publications in 1998. Long time ago, huh, for something so remarkable. So the study looked at 10 types of childhood adversity, the usual suspects, abuse and neglect, sexual, physical, verbal abuse, physical and emotional neglect. But then it also looked at five household dysfunctions. Divorce, living with a family member, particularly a parent who's an alcoholic or addicted to some other substance, living with a family member who's depressed or has some other mental illness, living with a family member who's been incarcerated or is incarcerated, and witnessing a mother being treated violently. Now, one thing that I think is really important to recognize is that these are just 10, but they are obviously not the only 10. There are other types of trauma that people experience. Bullying, natural disaster, war, racism. All those can have the same effects. In fact, other ACE surveys are starting to incorporate other types of trauma. Particularly looking at the populations that they're doing the surveys of and deciding what to include. So for example, the Philadelphia Urban ACE study included racism, witnessing violence outside the home, and living in an unsafe place. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, a pediatrician in San Francisco, has added 6 ACEs to the original 10, and included on her list is involvement with the child welfare system. So now people are getting into systems ACEs. In our country, we have a lot of schools that have a zero tolerance policy. The slightest infraction that a child commits, anywhere from chewing gum or talking on a cell phone, can result in many schools in being suspended or expelled, sometimes even taken to jail. Obviously, that's traumatizing, as can be involvement with the law enforcement system or the juvenile justice system. Even medical care can be traumatizing. And I think that as the ACE survey gets more mature, that you're going to start seeing more of these different types of ACEs in addition to these 10 being included. As the video mentioned, there were 4 really important pieces to what was learned in the ACE study. And one was it's extraordinarily common. In this population, there were of 17,000 mostly white, college-educated people had jobs in great health care. 2/3 had at least one of these types of ACEs. There's an unmistakable link between adverse childhood experiences and the adult onset of chronic disease, mental illness, violence, and being a victim of violence. Third, the more types of adversity, the more dire the consequences. This is really important, especially when you're looking at populations that experience other than the 10 ACEs from the original study, because those have just as much cumulative consequences as a number of ACEs from the original study. So, for example, compared with people who have 0 ACEs, those with 4 are more likely to be depressed, twice as likely to be smokers, 12 times more likely to commit suicide, 7 times more likely to be alcoholic. The risk of perpetrating domestic violence increases for men and for women, as well as being a victim of domestic violence increases. So people coming from the same soup there. Without intervention, as the video said, people with an ACE score of 6 or higher have a greater risk for a shorter lifespan by an astounding 20 years. And I say without intervention because the people who are in that category are the homeless, because from the get-go they have not been supported either from their family or their community, and they're not being supported now. So that's why you see, for those of you who have worked with homeless, you understand and experience this every day, that there are people who are 35 and look 70. Unemployment and disability increase with the number of ACEs. People who have high ACE scores have more marriages. I have an ACE score of 7 and 3 marriages. More broken bones, more obesity, higher rates of cancer and heart disease. You can really look at the ACE score as a cholesterol score for childhood trauma. The fourth finding, ACEs contribute to most of our major chronic diseases mental health, economic health, and social health issues. And take a look at the biology of hopelessness up here, because I'm going to talk about the biology of hope and the biology of hopelessness. In the U.S., there are 32 states now that have done their own ACE surveys and are finding similar results. The only difference is in sexual abuse. It tends to be much less than the original ACE study. And the reason, I asked Dr. Felitti about this, why he thought that was the case, and he said, well, the original ACE study, people took a piece of paper home with them, and they filled it out in the privacy of their own home, and they knew they were going to be handing in to someone who they trusted. And with the state surveys, what they do is there's a stranger calling you on the phone. There's probably some things you're not going to want to talk about. Across the world, there have been ACE surveys that have done in Romania, the Czech Republic, Macedonia, Norway, Philippines, Canada, China, Jordan, and England. This is the result of a study that was published in 2014. And I think this is very important to look at the consequences of that. The thing about the ACE study is if you have one type of ACE, at least for the original ACE study, there's an 87% chance that you have a second or two or more. And that's really important because childhood adversity doesn't come just in one thing. It's this complex approach. And so if we're just going to say, well, let's look at wiping out just child sex abuse, you'll never get ahead of it. Because adversity begats adversity, but it doesn't say what type of adversity is going to be coming from it. So you're not always going to have violence as a result of violence. You're going to have other things as well. So why do ACEs cause so much damage? And that's the second part of this theory of everything, or the unified science of human development. What happens to your brain when you have ACEs? And I understand that Bruce McEwen has been here a couple times to take a deep dive into the neurobiology of toxic stress, so I won't, and there's no way I could possibly even come close to his understanding of it since he figured it out. But it was originated by Bruce and amplified by Dr. Jack Schoenkopf at the Harvard Center of the Developing Child. And this is something that they, a nice graphic that they've developed. And as you can see, positive stress, we all need that to grow and thrive. Then there's tolerable stress, where there's a stress response, but then you recover. An example of that is giving a talk to 120 people and then having your host take you out to dinner afterwards. So toxic stress is the piece that is very damaging. And that is extreme, frequent, or extended activation of the body's stress response without the buffering presence of a supportive adult. And there's too many of those, for sure. So this long-term toxic stress, hold on a second, I want to need to move this here. So this is the kind that comes from living with a physically or verbally abusive alcoholic parent, for example. It actually damages the structure and the function of a child's developing brain. Toxic stress floods the brain with stress hormones, so that when a kid's in fight, flight, or freeze mode, they're back here in survival brain. They're not up here in thinking brain. And if they're not up here in thinking brain, it's this part of their brain that's being developed the most acutely. Because if you are in stress mode all the time and you want to survive, your brain's going to say, well, that's what I need to respond to. I can't be up here very much. I've got to be back here. So kids experiencing trauma act out. They can't focus. They can't sit still, or they withdraw. Fight, flight, or freeze response is very normal and expected. But what that means is they can't learn. And then their schools will further traumatize them if they act out or they withdraw, either by ignoring them or kicking them out of school. So when kids get older, they cope by drinking, overeating, doing drugs, smoking, as well as overachieving, doing thrill sports. To them, these are solutions. They're not problems. So for example, I said I had an ACE score of 7. For a while, I thought cocaine really worked well to block out the anxiety. And then when I realized that my mouth was watering when someone mentioned the word cocaine, I thought, I got to stop that. So I took up skydiving. I thought it was a really workable option because in that 60 seconds between the time I jumped out of the plane and the time I opened my parachute, I thought of nothing but being in the air and essentially flying. Everything else in my life, anxiety, depression, thinking how miserable I was, wasn't even part of my consciousness then. So what this is, you know, people talk about the pleasure center of the brain that these drugs are activating, but it's not. It's actually release and relief from what the brain is focusing on, this deep unhappiness that you're trying to get away from. It's a solution. So other drugs work just as well. Nicotine works to relieve anxiety, as many of you know. It works very well. Food soothes. Some drugs, such as methamphetamines, were the original antidepressants that were prescribed in the 1930s and 1940s. I know that in the United States, most of the people who went to fight the Korean War were given methamphetamines to get through it. So telling somebody how bad smoking is for them, if you want them to stop smoking, is not going to work. Telling somebody how bad heroin use is for them is not going to work if it's working for them, right? First, they have to get in a safe place before they can start using this brain to think beyond the next fix or the next way of soothing themselves. Because if when you're in fight, flight, or fright mode, you can't plan ahead a year or two. It's a lot more difficult to do that because you're right here in dealing with what you're doing. Say what? I know. Now they will since I do it. Thanks for letting me know, though. Okay, there we go. So that was a long diatribe about stress on the brain. And now stress doesn't just go in the brain, it goes in your whole body. And I think you've had someone talk about this as well, but for shorthand, it essentially stress erodes your organ systems, even your skin. There's a relationship between high ACE scores and skin cancer, a relationship between high ACE scores and autoimmune diseases. There isn't one part of the body that is not affected by stress. So that's the third part of the theory of everything. The fourth part is the epigenetic piece. I think Rachel Yehuda was here, and she talked about this in some detail. Essentially, we're born with the genes that we're born with, but they're turned on and off and on and off and on and off hundreds of times a day. And if you're living in a stressful situation, the genes that are turned on to deal with that stress will stay on, and that's what you can pass on to your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren if there's not intervention. This is the fourth part of the theory of everything. And here comes the good news. I know this has been bad news for a while, but here's the good news. Our brains are plastic and our bodies want to heal. We know a lot about how to increase individual resilience, to reduce stress in our bodies and our brains. We can meditate, which some people call flossing for the brain. Exercise, getting enough sleep, eating well, having safe relationships, living in a safe place, asking for help when we need it, seeing a counselor if we need to do that. It's simple advice, but gee, it takes a long time to integrate that in your lives, doesn't it? Especially if you come from a history of high ACE scores. We can build resilient families. We know that educating parents about their ACEs is very powerful. But if we're going to have healthy families, you've got to have healthy organizations, healthy systems, healthy communities to support those healthy families. You can't, this isn't just focusing on the kids or focusing on the families, it's focusing on the entire community cross-sector if we're going to have any chance of reducing ACEs in our population. So the frontier of resilience research is in communities and in systems. And by the way, in the individual piece of it, I did want to mention that there's some research that's being done at Stanford where they are taking teens with high ACE scores and they're giving them trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy and actually see their brains healing. So that's good news. So you can find stories about how people are implementing this amazing science and ACEs connection. That's what we do mostly, is look at how people are implementing these trauma-informed and resilience-building practices, how they're creating organizations and systems that prevent as well as stop traumatizing already traumatized people. Because this doesn't just happen in childhood, it happens throughout your life. This is a story we did about Lincoln High School in Walla Walla, Washington. The when Jim Sporletter, who was the principal there, first learned about the ACE study, he says, "I've been doing everything wrong when it comes to working with the kids who I've been disciplining." So in one year, he changed the school from throwing kids out the way that, or suspending them, the way that most schools do it in the U.S., to when a kid threw a chair or cussed out a teacher, they would say, instead of saying, "What's wrong with you? Why the hell did you do such a stupid thing?" they would say, "What happened to you? And how can we help you?" So in 1 year, suspensions dropped 85%. And expulsions dropped 40%. And in 4 years, suspensions dropped 90% total, and they stopped expelling the kids. And the kids' grades and test scores and graduation rates went up. Truancy rates went down. Absenteeism went down. More kids started going to college and to vocational education after school. The kids learned about the ACE study, and they actually developed their own ACE survey, and they added a ton more questions, some that Jim Sporletter said embarrassed him, but they wanted to know, so they included it. It was also anonymous, but the interesting thing was that the average ACE score for the kids in that high school was 5.5. The story inspired James Redford, who's the son of Robert Redford, to make a documentary called Paper Tigers. Has anybody seen it or heard about it in here? Good. 2, 3, 4. Great. It's a remarkable documentary, you know, that followed 6 kids through a year. And you could actually see them going from being hopeless to seeing that they had a future, just by experiencing this unconditional love that their teachers were giving them. There's one aside that I do want to say, and Jim Sporletter is the first to admit to this. The one thing that they didn't do, because they were a pioneer in the movement in the U.S. on this, they didn't pay attention to vicarious and secondary trauma. So he became so burnt out that he had to take a medical early retirement. And he's recovered pretty well now, and he's doing a lot of consulting with schools around the U.S., but it took a real toll on him. And you can see that in that year that they happened to follow, Jim and the staff. So the first thing he says is, take care of yourselves too. Dr. Vincent Folletti, who is the co-founder of the study, ACE study, says that there aren't enough therapists in the world to help everybody who has ACEs. So he thinks that everybody in the caring professions should know about it and integrate it into what they're doing, and so that they can have a role in helping people they work with. And here's a really good example of that. So this is Dave Lockridge He was an evangelical Christian pastor for a very a church in a very small, poor town in California when he learned about the ACE study. And he learned about it through his wife, who was director of medical education for a hospital in a nearby town. And he said the exact same thing that Jim Sporletter said when he learned about it. He said, "I have been doing everything wrong when it comes to helping my most troubled parishioners. I've been telling them to pray harder, and that's not going to do anything for them." So he closed his church. He went back and got a psychology degree. And then he put together a workbook that combines the epidemiology of ACEs, the neurobiology of toxic stress, and Bible studies. And he speaks to people who speak that language and who would never be able to afford a therapist. And of course, there aren't enough therapists to go around, even if they're offered the opportunity to go for free. So the first place that Dave took this was to rescue missions. And I don't know what they're called here, but those are faith-based last stop chances for people who have high ACE scores, really. And it's pretty much the last stop before the grave for most of the people in there, because not only have they given up on themselves, but all of society has given up on them. So here's a story. I went down and interviewed some of the people who had gone through Dave's course, and there was one woman I interviewed, and this is her story. So when she was, I think, 12 or 13, she was sexually abused by her uncle, and she went in to tell her parents, and her parents weren't really paying much attention to her. They were watching TV. She told them, and they said to her, "Don't talk like that in this house. You're talking dirty. You're just a dirty girl. We don't want to hear about this." Well, you can imagine what that must have done to her. So she thought, well, I must be a dirty girl. I probably deserved it, or I made it happen. So she lived out her life that way. She joined a gang. She started doing drugs, started drinking. She was in and out of jail a couple times. She had three children. They were all taken away from her by child welfare. She ended up in the rescue mission when she was in her 40s. Starting to look 60. She was sitting at a table when Dave was going through this course. And she was at one end of the table and he was at the other. And she was listening to him. And at one point she said to Dave, "You mean I'm not a dirty girl?" And he said, "No, you're not a dirty girl." That is an example of the biology of hope. Because she was completely hopeless about her life. She had completely given up. And she learned about this. And what she learned were four really important things. One, she wasn't born bad. Secondly, she wasn't responsible for the things that happened to her when she was a child. Third, she coped appropriately. What else was she going to do? No one was giving her healthy ways to build resilience factors. She didn't have any of that in her life. And the things that she did may have hurt her and maybe other people around her, but really it kept her alive. And fourth, she can change. And she did. She went back and got her high school degree. She got reconnected with her children and her grandchildren. She started working at this rescue mission as the administrator. I met her, and I don't think I've met anybody so vibrant and so happy to be alive. It's like she had just gotten her life back. It was really remarkable. And she wasn't the only person that I met that happened to. It was quite a few others that had many worse stories than I could possibly imagine. And I thought, as a journalist, I'd heard them all. There are trauma-informed judges, trauma-informed courtrooms, including a really interesting one called Safe Babies Courts in the U.S. I don't know if you have them here, but they've completely changed how they work with families. When there is child welfare comes in and starts working with a family, and because there's been a report of a child between the ages of, just born to three, This is when safe babies courts get involved. And instead of doing what is traditional, at least in the U.S., which is separating the child from the parents right away, what they do is they separate them temporarily, but only for a few days, and then they just put in these wraparound services for everybody, for the parents, for the extended family, if there's extended family, for the siblings, and that includes anything from employment services, counseling services, rehabilitation services, you name it, whatever they need, it's there. And the judge is there to say, okay, you pediatrician, get in here and work with these kids because they haven't had ever had a physical checkup, or you counselors, start getting here and working with this family and being on top of it, instead of saying, okay, you're going to be separated for 6 months, and mom, when you get off drugs, then you can get together back together with your child again. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some cases where the family has been allowed to, by our systems, to fall apart to such an extent that the damage is so severe that there's nothing you can do. There are those cases, and in those cases, they want to make sure that they get that young child, especially if they're babies, into the permanent home right away. But those are the minority. This way, it's really shown to have very powerful positive effects. In fact, of the kids that have gone through safe babies courts, 99% have no further abuse after a year, which is pretty remarkable. Pediatricians in Portland, Oregon are asking about the ACEs history from parents who bring their four-month-old babies into for a well baby checkup. And when parents learn they have a high ACE score, they say, this explains my life, and why did it take you so long to ask me about this? And then they're engaged because they want to know what they can do to not pass their score onto their children. The Family Center in Nashville, Tennessee has educated more than 1,000 parents about ACEs in the parenting classes they do for court-mandated parents, or parents who are mandated by the court to take the classes. And these are parents both in jail and out of jail. And you can see that the people that they're helping, I mean, when I saw this, my heart just about stopped, because, you know, there's so many that have such high ACE scores, and you think, how do we let it get to this stage, and what can we do to reverse it? So, as a result of learning about the ACEs, these parents say, also, this explains my life, and they want to know how not to pass on their ACEs to their kids. This knowledge engages them in a way that nothing else in these parenting classes has. And that, I think, is really interesting. Just this knowledge about their own experiences has engaged them in a way that parenting classes that are there to tell them how to be healthy, it hasn't done. And actually, I think that traditional parenting classes that say, this is how you behave to be a healthy parent, are setting up these parents for failure. Because if you think about a parent who has physical abuse in their background, and their cute little baby gets to the age of 2 and hits them, if their trigger response is to hit back, and they hit back without even going into thinking brain, but going right from survival brain, they're going to think, I'm a failure as a parent because I can't not hit my kid. But if you explain to them, this is your background, these are your triggers, and this is how to start self-regulating yourself so you can help your child self-regulate, it seems to have a better outcome. So the Family Center was also able to measure the parents who had gone through this part of the parenting class that had the ACE module. They had more empathy for their children. And that's because they understood that the kids' disruptive behavior, whatever behavior they didn't like from their kids, wasn't intentional. The kids weren't trying to piss them off. The kids were just being kids. And if they were distressed about something, that was the way that they were communicating that they were suffering some kind of trauma. So that understanding they could measure, which I think is pretty profound. Near at Home is a program and a toolkit that was developed in Washington State for home visitors. Do you have what's called home visitors here? Yeah, okay, great. In the US, they only work with poor families. Now, what I love about Near at Home and why and this toolkit that they developed is this is what they say. They say that learning about ACEs is a social justice issue. This is a quote. Parents have the right to know the most powerful determinant of their children's future health, safety, and productivity. This ACEs science. And to continue the quote, the most powerful people for reducing ACE scores in the next generation are parenting adults. Parents have the most opportunity and the potential for changing the trajectory of the public's health for generations. But parents must actually know about ACEs and their effects in order to realize this potential. Parents deserve to know. The largest public health discovery of our time, they should have the opportunity to talk about their own life experiences and consider how they might like to use new scientific discoveries to give their children greater health, safety, prosperity, and happiness than they had. So this isn't a deficit-based approach because it doesn't ask what's wrong with you. It asks what happened to you. And it helps people reframe their history so that they know that they weren't born bad, that they are not responsible for their childhoods, and that they can have hope to change their lives and their children's lives. So educating people about ACEs science does these four really important things. It engages the people you serve. It empowers people. It changes their understanding of others' behavior. And it opens a channel that, for them to tell you what they need. So remember the pediatricians that I mentioned who are taking the ACE survey of the parents of four-month-old babies? They thought that they were going to have to add a counselor to their staff because they thought that raising this was going to have people breaking down or asking for help or whatever, but they were all wrong. And this happens time and time again when you talk to organizations that have implemented ACEs. What they started getting, even though they were asking because they're required to ask, is there domestic violence in the home? They were mostly getting no's. But once they started talking with parents and developing this trusting relationship through these conversations, there started being parents saying, we've got domestic violence in the home. So they had to develop a whole protocol of response from emergency response just to providing information, you know, for counseling. That happens quite a bit in lots of other examples. When you start educating the people that you're serving, they're going to tell you what they need. And I think that's very important because there are a lot of trauma-informed programs out there that don't include this education about ACEs science, either for the organizations that are implementing it or for the people that these organizations are serving. And they can make significant progress, but they probably aren't going as far as they could be with this additional knowledge. So in other words, you've got to walk the talk. You have to look at your own organization through a trauma-informed lens because that will lead to the organization to looking at the people they serve as their partners in developing solutions with the understanding that ACEs touch all of us. We swim in the same ACEs ocean. We breathe the same ACEs air. Even if we have an ACE score of zero, we're affected by other people who have high ACE scores in lots of different ways. So in the US, the first state that is actually taking this on in a really organized way is Wisconsin. And this taught me that aces are not political, because Wisconsin is a very Republican state. The governor was actually running for president for a little while there in our melee of the Republican candidates. And his wife said, we need to do this, and we need to start at the state level. Now, they actually, in Wisconsin, there have been quite a grassroots development and movement that was going on in the state, and has been probably for the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years. And it got to the point where these communities were saying, now the state needs to understand this so that, they can speak our same language. So if they're not telling us things that can't work because we already know they can't, and they're not telling us to do things that that we don't think are possible, we need to work on this together. So Scott Walker, the governor, said, okay, 7 largest state agencies now are going to become trauma-informed, meaning that they're going to look at themselves through a trauma-informed lens and kind of figure out what they're up to for themselves before they start working with the organizations that they're directing that are doing direct services. It was just launched last week, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's a year-long program that they're working on. So as I mentioned, this knowledge touches everybody, every single sector in a community, every system, every person in some way, shape, or form. On ACES Connection Network, we aim to provide the tools that communities need to implement this. Besides the articles and resources that are shared by us and the network members, we also have groups, city, county, neighborhood, state groups, that support the face-to-face activities that are taking place in these communities. And we have quite a few tools to use for that. Our goal is, and I'll be going into that more detail tomorrow in a smaller meeting that we're going to have. But the goal is that the entire community integrates trauma-informed resilience-building practices based on ACES research. And the process to educate everybody, to engage them, to activate them, not by saying, here's what you have to do, but instead, here's this knowledge, what do you want to do? How can you use this knowledge to do things differently? And how can we support you to do that? And then the celebration part is telling the story, letting other people know your success, so that you can inspire more people to start doing this. And if you take a really 30,000 foot view of this, if you look at why this is so profound change, the way we've been for hundreds, thousands of years in dealing with people who's in trying to change the behavior of people, whether it's criminal behavior, unhealthy behavior, or just behavior you don't like, is blame, shame, and punishment. We're so steeped in it that it's just our knee-jerk reaction, right? Our systems are built around blame, shame, and punishment. All of our systems, even our public health system. Stop smoking, the nagging finger. Stop smoking. Why aren't you stopping smoking if I've given you all this reams and reams of information, you know? And if you haven't stopped smoking, there's something wrong with you, not in how I'm trying to help you. But with this knowledge, we have the potential to go from blame, shame, and punishment to understanding, nurturing, and healing, and building our systems around that. And there's enough information out there now in every single sector to show that it works. And we certainly have enough information to show that blame, shame, and punishment doesn't work, because we've got chronic disease out of control. We've got way too many people in prison. We've got school systems that are on the edge. We've got a medical community that's on the edge because they're so overburdened and they're not being given enough resources. So this way is actually showing us a way out of that situation. And it goes from what is wrong with you to what happened to you? How can I help you? And then, how can I help you heal? Not, I'm going to heal you. It's how can I help you heal yourself? So Dr. Robert Anda says that with this information comes the obligation to use it. And so what I will be doing in the, you know, from now on is seeing how you all use this and reporting about it so you can tell me how you are using it. Because the more that I can tell those stories, then you will inspire other people as well. So that's it. Thank you very much.